Welcome to Unloading, a community podcast focused on illuminating the diverse perspectives across the country about solutions to the epidemic of gun violence. I'm Kay, a fourth-year medical student from University of Colorado.
I'm Mijo, also a fourth-year medical student from the University of Colorado.
I'm Sarah, a third-year medical student from St. George's University.
Our hope is that these stories will inspire you to learn more about gun violence and take action in your own community. Today, we are fortunate to be joined by Dr. Amy Barnhurst. She's the Vice Chair for Community Mental Health at the UC Davis Department of Psychiatry and Associate Director of the California Firearm Violence Research Center at UC Davis, Professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine, and the Director of the Bullet Points Project, a state-funded effort to develop a firearm violence prevention curriculum for healthcare providers. Her academic work focuses on the interface between firearms, violence, suicide, and the mental health system, and she has testified before the California and Alaska Senate on these issues. We also have Dr. Cassie Stiegel, who is a pediatric emergency medicine fellow at the Eastern Virginia Medical School with an interest in advocacy and injury prevention. She has participated in many efforts to end gun violence and has published several academic papers on the topic. In a resident-driven quality improvement project, she helped implement Be Smart Education for pediatric residents that improved firearm accessing screening rates in a pediatric setting. She continues to do similar work and fellowship with implementing standardized lethal means counseling among the ED, inpatient psychiatry, and trauma departments, which includes screening for access to firearms. We have Dr. Stephen Hargerton, who is a professor of emergency medicine in the Medical College of Wisconsin, where he served as chair for over 20 years. He is also the founding director at the Comprehensive Injury Center and the founding dean for Global Health. His research interests reflect an intersection of injury and violence prevention and policy to address the burden of the biopsychosocial disease. His work in linking data systems for understanding violent deaths informed the development of the CDC's National Violent Death Reporting System. He was the founding president of the Society for the Advancement of Violence and Injury Research and has served on the Violence and Injury Prevention Mentoring Committee for the World Health Organization. He is also a member of the National Academy of Medicine. Dr. Emmy Betts is a professor of emergency medicine and professor of epidemiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, where she is also the founding director of the Firearm Injury Prevention Initiative and deputy director of the Injury and Violence Prevention Center. She is founding member of the Colorado Firearm Safety Coalition. She also oversees a multi-million dollar research portfolio funded by the National Institute of Health and Department of Defense, focusing on ED provider attitudes towards lethal means restriction of suicide prevention, suicidality among older adults, public opinion about firearm safety discussions, and strategies for enhancing patient-provider communication about sensitive topics.
Thank you all so much again for joining us today. We'll just go ahead and get started. So our first question for all of you is, how did you first become interested in involving firearm safety into your practice?
I was in private practice in Milwaukee and not seeing much of any serious injuries in my practice. And when I moved to the Medical College of Wisconsin as a faculty member in the Level 1 Trauma Center, it happened at the time in 1989, 1990, when the United States and many communities across the country became involved in handling major numbers of gunshot wound victims in the emergency departments, really a first true epidemic that occurred in the early 90s. And that's when I became interested in understanding it better, understanding not so much the treatment, because I was doing some things. Having the surgeons take care of that biomedical aspect of it. And I started to examine and go upstream wondering what's going on here. How can we better understand it? So I got involved because I was starting to see patients in that first epidemic back in the 90s.
I first got involved when, I think it was in 2012 when the Sandy Hook shooting happened, and I was running a crisis unit here in California. And I was hearing all this media coverage about, you know, the mental health system should have stopped this guy. The mental health system failed us here. Why didn't the mental health system, you know, identify this guy and do something about him? And I thought, well, I am the front lines of that mental health system. And if the cops had brought, you know, one of these guys to me, I don't know what I would have done. I don't know that I would have, you know, legally had any recourse to do something with somebody who didn't want treatment, didn't want to take meds, and, you know, didn't want to be there. And also, I don't know what treatment I could offer somebody to make them not, you know, be angry and vengeful. And I also had kids in elementary school at the time. And so it was really, changed my perception of like, oh, this is a really safe place where I can leave my children while I go off to work and know that when I come get them at the end of the day, they will still be there. And it rocked my world a bit. And I had this revelation after a while when those two worlds sort of came together, like, oh, I'm not completely powerless here. Like I can actually do something about, you know, how upsetting this was to me as a parent through my role as a physician.
Yeah, for me, Sandy Hook was a turning point also in many ways, but I had become interested before that in this space, I think for two reasons. So one, I have a family history of suicide losses and had long felt the sort of aftershocks of that. And then as an emergency physician who mostly works in adult EDs, honestly felt like we do a terrible job of caring for suicidal patients. We like seem to not know what to do and just leave everything up to the psychiatry team, which not to say anything bad about psychiatry team, but just like there often aren't enough mental health professionals and there's so much that we as ER physicians can be doing. So I had become interested in the firearm suicide piece and how could I as a physician have effective conversations with patients at risk of suicide. And then I think when Sandy Hook happened, I became interested in the larger conversation, but honestly also because I was pretty angry that when we started talking about gun violence as a bigger picture, suicide was often left out because it felt to me like we were somehow not counting those deaths the same. And I felt like we were missing some of the complexity and nuance in the same way that we were often not discussing the daily deaths from community, often youth involved interpersonal violence in urban areas. And so I think like Amy, I was angry at first and then I felt like, what can I actually do? And realized I actually had this maybe unique role as a clinician to help both my patients, but also have a voice in the larger discussion.
Okay. I got involved really like the first week of residency, and I got really lucky. That's something that I was taught in medical school that I assumed to be true. Like everywhere, I was very naive, realized it's very different when you are now like in a resident clinic or a pediatric hospital, and things that you're taught don't necessarily happen. And so that was something that I was like, why are we not doing this? And was able to get involved in a QI project, like literally the first week of my intern year. And it just so happened that's something that I've always been very passionate about, and something that I want to be able to do to advocate for patients, for safety, for their families to be safe, their communities to be safe. And so it's just finding something that you're interested in and then realizing how you can go ahead and improve upon the current system that you're in.
Thank you all so much for your responses. Those are really inspiring stories.
Yeah, we'll go more into kind of about emergency medicine. So how are firearm discussions kind of approached in emergency medicine? And on top of that, how do you approach these discussions, particularly with individuals you assess that to be at high risk for self-injury, or individuals whose families may be at risk for injury due to suboptimal gun storage practices, or even individuals who are less open to discussing firearm safety in general?
I'll jump in first. So I work in an ER that serves mostly adults. So I'm going to leave kids aside for a second. Honestly, we're all a little bit terrified when a kid somehow makes it to our ER because children's hospitals across the street. And so kids are an important part of this conversation, but I'm not going to address them. I think there are kind of three main clinical scenarios when I think about firearms and firearm access. So the first is risk of community interpersonal violence, often with adolescents, young adults. And I want to just say that's an incredibly important area. We know particularly Black and Brown communities have much higher rates of much higher risk of violence, but it's a very different approach. And so I'm fortunate to work at a hospital that has a violence intervention program where we can consult peer specialists who come and ideally engage individuals in a kind of a wraparound project. Really important program. There are great national models for this, but it's not about talking about gun safety. Like it's about the upstream risk factors. But that is the first situation that I think we're not going to talk about as much today, but is important for sure to recognize. The second, I would say, is domestic violence. I think this is the one we have the hardest time with still, because it's a really nuanced situation where, you know, we know that a victim of or survivor of domestic violence, if there's a gun in the relationship, the risk of death to that person is much higher. And yet it's also often a very complicated situation, particularly if there are kids involved, and how do we support that individual who's often a woman in making decisions for themselves and understanding the risk, but sort of also understanding options. And it's not as easy as just locking up the gun. I think it's a space where we have a lot of work to do still in terms of interventions and approaches that are really patient-centered and effective. And then the third space where I spend most of my time thinking, and honestly, it's probably where I see the most patients on every shift, is someone with acute suicide risk. So someone who's either brought in for suicidality or even after an attempt, or someone who's identified through our screening. And that's where we generally have a discussion as the physician, but then also we have 24/7 behavioral health coverage, and those specially trained individuals usually have a longer discussion as well as part of a safety plan. And we can dive more into that, but those are sort of the three scenarios, I think, in my ER, at least, where it comes up probably the most, where we're having conversations.
I'm not really an ER doc. I'm a psychiatrist, even though I have a joint appointment. I always say, like, I'm an ER doc at heart, and I thought that's what I was going to go into. And then I discovered I have a really early bedtime, and so it didn't work out for me in emergency medicine. But I get to still go to the ER a lot, and I do psychiatry there, and I feel fortunate that I have more time than I think folks like Emmy and Steve do, because, you know, I don't have quite the caseload and I don't see the people who are like dying right in that moment. I see people who are more at risk for that downstream. And it is hard because there's, you know, we all work in gun violence prevention, but we also have so many things we have to worry about in our clinical situation. And in psychiatry, I think I actually have fewer that are more violence focused. But ER docs have to worry about all of the bad things, you know, like the, you know, MIs and the strokes and the PEs and the all those other things I've forgotten since medical school. I have a slightly more limited scope of bad things I have to worry about. And so I can go a little bit deeper into talking to people about whether they're, you know, actually have risk factors. And then if they do, what's their access to firearms and how does that factor in? So I see a lot of folks who, you know, come in for feeling suicidal, or they've made threats to hurt somebody else, or they're just really, really psychotic, or they got really agitated because they were high on meth. And it's not just their storage practices per se that are affecting that. It's, are there guns around? You know, maybe they are stored safely, but they know the combo. Maybe they're, you know, from a firearm-owning family and they can get a hold of a gun really easily. Maybe they live in a community where everyone's armed. And so, you know, it's about access even beyond how things are stored within the home, even though that is a really important piece of it.
So similar in regards to like having any type of like active suicidal crisis within at least the pediatric emergency department, I have been able to get the most buy-in from providers as well as families when I am talking about how do you store your firearms in your home or in your vehicles when their child is coming in and they're actively suicidal. The issue is that is not addressing then a lot of unintentional firearm morbidity and mortality that we'll see in the pediatric ED. And the issue is that I'm not able to catch that upstream enough. And so I know that St. Louis, WashU Children's, they've been able to do universal screening for all pediatric patients coming in for how they store their firearms at home. And they had to go ahead and look at the numbers of how many unintentional firearm mortality morbidity that they are taking care of to be able to get buy-in within that institution. I've now struggled to do that at two different institutions, but it's one of those things where partnering with your violence intervention program and different social workers in the primary care clinic and different aspects of the healthcare system needs to be done to be able to address it from a preventative means. And when I've talked to families, children coming in with, you know, they're actively suicidal, there's never been any issues because everyone wants to make sure that their child is safe. So that I found has to be the most effective way to have both attendings, residents, fellows, social workers, nurses be all on board with implementing that within our system.
When I got started, and maybe a little history from my perspective, and I think, Amy, you mentioned domestic violence and the thorny issues there. When I first started at the academic center, the resident was dutifully reporting to me the bruises to the woman's face. X-rays were negative, and she said she's ready for discharge. And I said, okay, what happened? And the resident said, I don't want to know. I don't want to know that it's domestic violence because I don't know what to do about it. And I think with leaders like Emmy and Amy, you're populating curriculums, you're actually making a difference in systems so that when you do ask the question, is there a firearm in the home? Is it stored properly? It's done with trained people doing it, and there's resources that perhaps could be given to the family in need to properly store it and so forth. So, and Emmy, your work with the veterans is another example of assuring that a firearm may be removed from the home for a period of time so that this person can get through their mental health challenges. So a lot has happened in the right direction towards the emergency department in the chaos to be more broad in its approach to these patients so that the biomedical needs are immediately taken care of. And then the behavioral health issues are taken care of by wonderful consultants like Amy and others, and social workers who can follow up, and the interventionalists that are becoming more and more popular across the United States. So a lot has changed in the right direction than when I started, when we really weren't able to, or we were afraid to ask the question, what happened, or are you at risk? Do you have a firearm in the home? So it's a really great progress that we're making in this area.
First off, thank you, Steve, for your lovely words. Thank you for also laying the groundwork here for those of us who are coming after. I think I wanted to respond to something both Cassie and Steve brought up, sort of this issue of like Pandora's box, and also the question of asking the question and screening versus counseling, and like, what are we actually trying to do here? And I think this is an area of ongoing hot debate in the field. If you think about it,
sort of, I would agree.
What we get excited about. And I'll tell you kind of my own personal opinions about it. I don't think that there's evidence that, for example, universal screening about firearm access, universal meaning every single patient who comes into my ER, I don't think there's evidence that that does anything good for patients. And partly because we don't know what to do with the information necessarily. If I see someone with an ankle sprain who otherwise has no risk factors for firearm injury and he has a gun at home, like, what am I going to do with that information? So the most important thing to me is, does it affect patient outcomes? And I would say universal screening broadly in clinical settings, I don't think does affect patient outcomes. It may increase burden on providers, and it may actually really anger some patients. And that might be a very small subset of patients, but I think we need to be really careful about not alienating and causing uproar from a subset of people if there's not strong rationale for what we're doing. Having said that, I want to clarify that I do think in certain populations, universal education or counseling or sort of provision of resources is incredibly important. And I would argue pediatric settings are one of those. So I would love it if in pediatric practices, whether it's ERs or pediatricians, instead of asking the questions, we're just giving out information or gun locks broadly, because even if you don't have a gun in your home, your kid might be in a home with a gun. I think parents need to know about unintentional injury. They need to know about suicide. And similarly, in geriatric settings where dementia is prevalent, I think there could be broad universal counseling. But again, that's different than screening. And then in certain high-risk populations, we should have targeted screening. So specifically to what Amy was talking about, people with suicide risk, absolutely, we need to be asking the question and having a nuanced and respectful conversation with them about that access. But I really don't want us to get to a point where we're pushing for like the nurse at triage asking, do you have guns in your home? The same way they ask about smoking and drinking and all those other things, because there's not necessarily a benefit. And it's going to, I think, potentially really make some patients incredibly angry and has the potential to do damage.
I want to come down on Team Emmy on this debate, although it really is, it comes up all the time. Yes, it's almost like we've worked before together, Emmy. Yeah, it comes up all the time because I think that, you know, there is an idea about universal screening as being like the best way to catch things, but that's the basic principle in public health, right? Is you don't screen for stuff if you're not going to do anything about it, either because there's no potential negative outcome or you don't have the tools and resources to do anything. It's not going to change your clinical decision-making. And, I run a project called Bullet Points that's funded by the state of California, and it addresses, you know, exactly what Steve, the story you told Steve about your resident being like, I just don't want to know because then I'm just going to worry and I will have no tools. I can't do anything. And I hear that a lot from people. They're like, I don't want to ask because I don't want to know because there's nothing I can do. But there is something you can do if you have the education and the tools So Bullet Points was created to address that. And we have really taken this approach that Emmy talks about in training clinicians how to have these conversations, which is identify a risk. And then you ask, you know, everyone who comes in for like a funny looking mole to their dermatologist doesn't necessarily have a risk. And then that dermatologist has to go through all the, you know, they already ask you if you're in pain. And if you tell your dermatologist you're in like 9 out of 10 ankle pain, what are they going to do about that? You know, the universal screening for all these things sometimes is just, you know, potentially is going to have a negative effect on your patient rapport, especially with a politically sensitive topic like firearms. And it gets sort of added to this checklist that I think providers can sometimes find meaningless rather than identifying the people who are at risk and having like a tailored, meaningful, personalized conversation about something.
I just want to ask before we lose that, Dr. Barnhus, can you tell us like where can students, residents, and other clinicians find this tool, the bullet points?
Oh, yeah. So bulletpointsproject.org is our website. There's a lot of good information on there. There's various clinical scenarios about like dementia, suicide risk, mass shooting threats, domestic violence, places where a firearm really does augment the risk of injury or death. And then all of those pages link to pages on interventions tab, which walk through some of the things that clinicians can actually do if they identify a patient at risk, according to the person at risk, the type of risk, how big the risk is. We have a 1-hour online CME course that's free that you can access on demand and get an hour of CE credit for. We do a lot of teachings and trainings. We're available for presentations for grand rounds, medical students, whatnot. We have a podcast series. So there's a lot. There's an educator's toolkit for people who want to incorporate this into their teaching for medical students. And also it's for medical and mental health care providers. So psychologists, social workers as well.
There's interest in this all across the country, which is great. And I think that's where I'm seeing so much progress being made that is more comfortable. I agree completely with Emmy and Amy about the universal screening. Think about in the ED setting, our nurses, our triage nurses are asking a lot of questions already about things that perhaps might be harmful, or they're being asked to do it because the hospital requires it. So there's a lot of work to do exactly what Emmy was talking about is, do we need to screen? Who do we need to screen? Then who do we counsel? How does that get nuanced so that we get the best outcomes that we possibly can? And that's viewed, I think, increasingly, and it should be, as good patient care. I don't want to know is not good patient care. And I think that's where we all get united about doing the very best we can in the short time we're with our patients.
You guys have all brought up such excellent points. And we just talked about like, you know, a new question we just want to ask, which was, you know, you talked a lot about, you know, psychiatry and being like, you know, in the ED. And we were just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that kind of interdisciplinary collaboration, like what really makes that interaction more fruitful in some cases and, you know, really helps in mitigating firearm violence.
So that's a great question and one that I've been thinking more and more, but didn't have a chance to incorporate it while I was actively seeing patients. And that's the biopsychosocial model that was actually described by Dr. Engel in 1976, where we more broadly need to address our patients, not from the narrow biomedical needs that the patient may have, their diabetes, they have a gunshot wound, but there's psychosocial issues, the behavioral injury that has taken place with this patient and the social care that this patient needs with the fact that this gunshot wound now has totally disrupted their lives. And so I think Amy's not going to be so happy when I say this. I don't think we need a psychiatrist embedded in the emergency department. I think a psychologist who is in connection, is in consultation with a psychiatrist and a social worker seeing the patients concurrently, every gunshot wound victim ought to be seen with a team. And in our institution, not only seen by a team, they're followed up with a team. They go to a clinic specially designed for follow-up that has a surgeon, a behavioral psychologist, and a social worker. And I think whether it be a psychiatrist or a psychologist doesn't matter to me. It needs to address the behavioral care. So the multidisciplinary approach, Caitlin, is certainly one that I'm very keen on seeing happen more and more, not only in emergency departments, but in follow-up clinics that are taking care of gunshot wound victims.
I'm not mad to hear that, Steve. I'll just go home. It's fine.
You already said you don't like working nights, so.
Yeah.
I think it's so true what you said, Stephen. I think for anyone listening to the podcast who hasn't chosen a specialty yet, hopefully you've already realized emergency medicine is the best field. In all seriousness, one of the reasons that I love the clinical field of emergency medicine is that you're really embedded with a whole team of people working side by side. So nurses, techs, social workers, care managers, behavioral health specialists, and then certainly all of the consultants who come down. But I think that's really what we need. I am so grateful to be in a setting where we have social workers 24/7 who can address all kinds of things from homelessness to substance abuse or financial issues, all of the sort of social determinants of health that are affecting a person's risk. I think along with then the mental health specialists, and I think it's important to have access to trained mental health professionals, like Amy said, who have time and have expert training. I also, though, think it's really important we in emergency medicine don't immediately just hand over responsibility. I often tell residents, it's like someone with chest pain. We learn how to read EKGs and we pride ourselves on that. And we should be able to do at least initial assessment, risk assessment, for example, for someone with suicidality, and then call a consultant for additional guidance rather than sort of throw up our hands at the first point. I know Cassie works more in pediatric ER settings, and I'm sure has some thoughts here too that I'd be interested in. I know particularly in trauma teams or in violence as related to youth, there's a whole nother level that comes in thinking about parents and specialists that also is really important.
Yeah, so I'm spoiled because I've always been somewhere that has a very robust community violence intervention program and an on-patient psychiatrist or like a PA or an NP like 24/7 with social workers in-house 24/7. And so when families come in for a GSW, that team will automatically get consulted. They'll see them in the ER, or if they're admitted to the trauma team, they'll see them there, and then they'll do home visits. And they really act as like a coordination of care with case management. And then a lot of children who are like, say they're paraplegic from their GSW, they will come into the ER multiple times for various things. And when they come in, this like whole team knows them already. So it's like a huge support system. And so that being said, like, again, like I'm spoiled because I've always been within that setting. And it depends on also like, obviously how close the family is to, you know, the children's hospital in the area. But it's huge to be able to support these families so that they can get access to care and, you know, have outpatient services, which they will need because it's a very traumatic event, not just for the kid, but for the parents themselves and every other child in that family.
Yeah, and I think what Steve said, you know, in all seriousness, it's true that so much of what needs to be addressed with patients who are at risk of firearm injury, or like the people Cassie see, the kids who have already suffered an injury, is all that psychosocial stuff that happens outside the walls of the hospital and around the injury. It's not just the injury. And more so than other specialties, psychiatry really involves things like housing and employment and community and family and education and, you know, all of the other stuff that we don't actually have the power to like prescribe or infuse in any way. And you don't need a psychiatrist to address those things. I mean, we can, but that's stuff that social work and psychologists can address as well. I think that in the sort of spirit of the emergency room, where the emergency providers are the frontline providers that take care of that first part, like Emmy talked about, reading the EKG and stabilizing people, and then, you know, maybe sending them off to cardiology is necessary. The ER providers can do that for a lot of the cases, and where they need to come to psychiatry is somebody who's like, you know, first break psychosis, and that's putting them at risk of, you know, violence or suicide, or somebody who's, you know, really got an intractable depressive episode and their bipolar disorder and needs their meds adjusted. So psychiatry obviously needs to work really closely with psychology and social work and the other folks who are helping work on the whole person that is all contributing to this, but we can contribute to making the disease state better, if that is what is contributing to the risk factors.
Amy, is your work sometimes when you see a patient, do you, right after they're being treated with a gunshot wound, that they're already developing or at risk of developing post-traumatic stress? They are exhibiting symptoms that can and should be not only recognized, but the therapy to control it to be started as soon as possible?
You know, I don't often see, because ironically, because I'm in the ED, I don't see those folks, because the people who have actually been shot and then make it to psychiatry, they make it to psychiatry after they've been stabilized and operated on and admitted to the hospital and then on the trauma service. And then they call us about that PTSD. And I don't work on the CL service as much anymore, but oftentimes we do see those folks and they're really struggling. A lot of hospitals, Davis has one, but a lot of hospitals now have these hospital-based violence intervention programs that offer wraparound services to those folks. And it's everything from like the sort of acute stress disorder, which is the PTSD precursor. So addressing that with therapy, meds if they need it for insomnia or anxiety, but also talking to them about like, okay, so like this happened at, you know, some beef you had with some other kids at school. Like, is there a way we can, you know, get you out of those classes, get you out of that district? This is something that was going on in your community. Is there a way that, you know, you can stay with other family members elsewhere? Is there stuff we can do to like get you job training? Is there stuff we can do to help support your family through this time? So again, it's that psychosocial wraparound piece that they can really provide, but certainly the potential to develop a more chronic PTSD disorder or PTSD-like disorder is there as well.
I want to riff off of sort of sad, but we're talking about I love this prevention of downstream psychological consequences after injury. I think what we would all really love to see is how do we prevent that first injury from even happening? And I think one of the things many of us, this isn't where I first started, but I think many of us have found our way to, is realizing we need to also get outside of the walls of our hospitals, because many patients, especially with suicide, never actually make it to us, don't seek help. Many of those youth who end up being injured or shot, we may not pick them up ahead of time. And I think there are so many wonderful ways we as physicians and as medical students can have an impact outside of the hospital. So whether it's that you're engaged in issues around homelessness or substance abuse or whatever ills are sort of facing your community, your community's facing, or you know, in my case, I've moved out and very surprisingly to me, ended up doing a lot of work in firearm businesses around how do we promote suicide prevention messaging sort of before people get into risk, before they make it to my ER. So I think there's incredible opportunities for people to have an impact outside of their clinical practice too, for people who are interested in this space.
Yeah, you guys have all touched on, I think, really important things, which is that obviously firearm violence and injuries, a multidisciplinary approach. And there's so many factors that come into play before people even present to the ED, which kind of brings us into our third question or fourth question, which is, you know, would you be willing to share a story of an interaction that you've had with a patient who has experienced gun violence and how that's really shaped your work or perspective on the topic of gun violence and safety?
I'll start. Mine is unfortunately one that reaffirmed me the importance of doing this work. So as it will be true for all of us, but so I've been in emergency medicine almost 20 years. And in that time, I have seen two patients with a suicide attempt by firearm. And that speaks to the lethality of those attempts, because usually people with a suicide attempt by gun don't get to us. They die at home. And yeah. So we end up having a very skewed view, I think, sometimes of what gun violence is and sort of what our patient population is at risk of. So within the past few years, though, I saw a patient who had attempted suicide with a firearm with a gunshot wound to the head. It had happened nearby our hospital is really the reason that he was brought in. I was not able to interact with him. He had a devastating non-survivable wound to his head, but was pseudo-stable, intubated, still with signs of life and so forth, but really not conscious at all. And for me, it was the interaction with his wife, who had gotten a text message from him right before he attempted and basically told me they were both in their early 40s. It was a second marriage for him. Marriage had been great, but she said they'd had, in her words, a stupid fight the night before. He'd been stressed out about work. He'd been drinking more than usual, sort of the classic constellation of symptoms. They had this fight, which again, she said was not marriage ending, that things were fine, but he was stressed about work. And the thing that made the difference was that unfortunately he had a gun that morning, and was able to use the gun in his suicide attempt. And in that moment when he made the decision to pull the trigger, there was no second chance for him anything else. And probably we could have gotten him through it, or he could have regretted what he'd done and called for help himself. Even if it was a Tylenol overdose, the most lethal meds, the likelihood that we could have saved him would have been really different. And so the only thing we could do for him was really for his wife. And we had the chaplain come to bedside at her request, and at her request also withdrew care in the ER. And I stayed, I don't know, an hour or more after my shift just to sit with her while he passed away. And again, the whole time I felt like I was very conscious of how could I reduce her grief, her burden, her guilt, anything that our team could do for her healing process, because we couldn't save him. And had he not had that gun, he would have still been there. And it just again highlighted to me the difference that that gun can make in that moment of crisis, which is often very brief and often this constellation of really in the end up being kind of minor things, but they all cluster together. So I think just again, it to me really highlighted how much ideally we can be doing as communities, as cultures, as clinicians, in terms of educating people about the risk of having firearms in those dark moments.
Yeah, I don't have, that was a very poignant story, Emmy. Thank you for sharing. I do reflect on some of the patients that I've seen over the years, a very gentle African-American 25 or so, and he was paralyzed with a bullet in his spine. These are pictures of or patients that I have seen, but I never had a chance to develop much of a relationship with them. And so I really have focused my work with the flow of patients and the constant flow of patients to relive the story of the riverbank parable, where you keep pulling out the river, the drowning man, and you keep doing it over and over again. And you figure out, you start thinking, well, who the hell is pushing them all in the river? And as Emmy was starting to say, as you go outside the emergency department to find out how can we better understand this problem. That was my work with linking the medical examiner information with the police reports and the firearms linked with those events. That's the, we did the pilot work that further informed the eventual formation of the National Violent Death Reporting System. So my work has been to better understand what is going on. That's, I think, the strength of the National Violent Death Reporting System. And in my work more recently is better understand the firearm itself as a product, and as a product that carries bullets, and what do bullets do in patients, and how do we better understand this by looking at the microscope of this disease, if you will, the video camera, to understand what do bullets do and how can we better care for patients and perhaps maybe inform policymakers about categorizing these products in a different way. So I've reacted to the flow of patients that I've seen over the years with going upstream and better understanding what's going on and developing information systems. And Emmy, you've got a ways to go, because I practiced emergency medicine for 37 years and I finally said, okay, that's enough.
So, I don't know if I'm going to make it. It's
well, I don't know either, but you got the students around you to keep you going. You've got to keep going, yeah. Emmy, come on.
I know. And in seriousness, I think to everybody listening into the group here, I think all knows it too. I think in any field in clinical medicine, these are hard jobs. And I think we all find our ways to sort of refill our buckets. And for me, certainly it's around this, as Steve says, going upstream and trying to figure out how to prevent problems is what keeps me from getting burned.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually talking to the medical students next week about advocacy. I mean, I can't agree with you more. It really is the way to target your activities in a way that's different and as important. So, yes, I agree.
Yeah. I'll tell a story that's a little bit more unusual, I guess, less told. But I think it highlights some important points, which is of a young man who was brought into the crisis unit where I worked by the FBI because he had been, you know, posting things on his Instagram about, you know, kind of these vague homages to previous mass shooters, a picture of himself holding a gun, some messages to classmates about, like, you know, don't come to school, like something's going to happen, really vague stuff. So nothing like direct threat, nothing super specific, but enough that like local people at the school called local law enforcement who called the FBI and everybody was very concerned about this guy. They couldn't really charge him with anything. So of course they were sort of like, well, maybe the mental health system can do something about this guy. They brought him to me. You know, it wasn't the first person who sort of fit that profile and had done that sort of constellation of things that I had seen. But I think because there had been a number of shootings, you know, more recently by the time I saw him, I kept him on an involuntary hold, even though I really didn't see a lot of signs of like true mental illness. And I wasn't quite sure what we would be treating. And I thought, you know, it's very likely that a judge could let him go. But again, because I think of partly because of the political climate, the judge was willing to uphold his commitment and keep him in the hospital. So we had him for a while. We treated him with, you know, some like low level antipsychotic to see if he changed any. And meanwhile, the FBI investigated their case against him. And so it's sort of like the mental health system was doing what they could do. The legal system was doing what they could do. But in the middle of it was this like 18-year-old kid who was just like angry and lost and felt abandoned by his family and thought all his peers hated him. And he was just basically over it. You know, he was like, I'm done. He was totally in this nihilistic space. And I honestly, my personal opinion is that it wasn't really the medications, but he stayed with us for a couple months because people were really afraid to let him go. And in that time, we were able to link him with a wraparound youth mental health services that provide everything from medications to case management to housing support to like home study to activities. And they were able to get him, you know, out of his family home, which was a really bad environment for him. And he had a sort of toxic relationship with his parents or his mom, whoever was there, and into a group home where he was living with other, you know, kids kind of like himself. They got him a job. They helped him get his GED and transfer to a community college. And this was all after like months of psychiatric treatment, months of being investigated by multiple law enforcement agencies. And ultimately it all came together. Like, they never pressed charges against this kid, and we didn't have him on meds long-term, and he never went to jail. He never was on a conservatorship. He went out to this like wraparound mental health services program, and, you know, knock wood, it's been years later, and I have not heard from him. I know for a while I would sort of get reports and he was doing well. And it was kind of a similar thing to what Emmy talked about, like getting through that crisis time. And yes, it was a really different crisis. And yes, the outcome of that crisis could have been on a bigger scale, but 18-year-olds go through really bad times. And I know we don't often try to like find empathy for the people who perpetrate these horrible acts. And oftentimes they come from really bad places, their intentions. But ultimately, some of those same social factors that go into suicide risk and that go into the risk of community violence go into the risk of mass violence as well. And it's the feeling disconnected, the feeling isolated, the feeling like there's nothing worth living for. You know, there's a lot of overlap with suicidality and just this sort of like hopeless nihilism. And I think there is an increasing amount of effort being put into thinking about what do we do with these folks? If they come into our mental health practice, like we can't just be like, ooh, yuck, we're not do anything. Like you're just a bad person, because that's not helpful to anybody. We need to think about how do we off ramp them? How do we treat them? How do we get them better? How do we rehabilitate them? And I think a lot of the things that we have to think about doing overlap with the same principles we use in suicide prevention and in community violence prevention.
I don't have stories really about patients. It's really more about my interactions with families. And that being said, for someone that's been only doing, like I've been in training for 5 years, and I've seen like a disgustingly high number of children die from gunshot wounds, either from suicide or unintentional, and a few homicides. But I think that's just because like we don't declare kids until they come into the ER, until the family's there, or they'll go up to the PICU and they'll become organ donors. And so when I've had a child, 6-year-old, found the family gun, shot himself in the brain, herniated, sister saw it, you know, and it's just terrible. And those families, like, I can still remember their screaming, their cries. And it's like me in a room with like this whole like eight people while I'm trying to explain what happened and that their child is not going to come back. I've had a kid who found the firearm in the car and shot his sister. I've had kids that fired the firearm on the uncle who's currently visiting from out of town and shoot themselves. So like in their hand and their leg and their back. And so like each time this family is obviously extremely distraught and they're like, why did this happen to me? Like, this is not fair. And they're so upset in that moment. And there's nothing that I can really do aside from comfort them, right? And so what I will do to be able to try to, I guess, like reason with this and find a way to give back is like, I will go to the Capitol and I'll talk about triple safe storage. I'm involved in a group formed by Emily Lieberman who is trying to pass an assault weapons ban. And so like, I'll go to DC with them because like, what can I do in that moment to help that family? Like aside from trying to offer them comfort and give them a hug, I'm not going to be like, you should have stored your gun correctly. Like, no, that's not appropriate. But what I can do is, you know, make future efforts to make it so that a child will not be able to find their family's gun and accidentally shoot themselves. And I shouldn't use the word accident. People are very upset about that word, but unintentionally harm themselves. And so I see the kids that come in who are paraplegic and, you know, they're depressed. They have a lot of psychosocial issues, but the families, I think, are the thing that stands out to my mind the most. And I still struggle with it, but I want to continue to struggle with it because it keeps you motivated to keep going.
Thank you all so much for sharing. All the stories you shared are very deeply affecting. There seems to be a theme of reflecting on what we in healthcare can be doing to better understand gun violence and better understand how we can help these patients and their families. So as our closing question, what is one thing you would like other healthcare providers and trainees to know about gun violence and firearm injuries or what we could be doing?
I'll jump in on this one. Gun owners are not bad people. And some of you may laugh to hear that or be like, what is she talking about? But I really do think that we in healthcare and in society in general, honestly, need to sort of check some of our biases. I think particularly we in healthcare have this privileged space where we work with people from all backgrounds, all lifestyles, all everything, right? And we are trained and have the opportunity to work with people on sensitive topics, even if we don't see eye to eye with them. Maybe it's religious beliefs about various procedures or blood transfusions. Maybe it's sexual orientation, lifestyle choices, like all kinds of things, right? I care for people all the time who have very different lives than me. And I try very hard to meet them with empathy and with a focus on their health and well-being and wanting them to have a healthy outcome. And I think it's really important that we do that also when we're thinking about firearm safety and sort of recognize our own perspectives, backgrounds, biases. And we're allowed to have those, of course. We're allowed to have our own opinions and be involved in the legislative process or advocacy or whatever it is we want. But I think we really need to check those biases at the door when we go in to talk with patients. And I often think about when I was a medical student and we were learning how to take a sexual history and we were all very embarrassed and giggly and like asking people how they have sex with other people and it felt so invasive and oh my goodness, I don't even think about that now, right? Like it just rolls because I talk about everything with patients. And I think that's what as an individual clinician you need to get to whatever's appropriate for your space. I realized for myself I was really uncomfortable asking people about firearm access in the context of suicide risk in particular because I didn't really know what to say or like what to do next. So honestly, I just had to practice. I had to think about where my biases were, think about where my knowledge gaps were, figure out what I felt like I needed to do to fill those knowledge gaps, and then honestly practice some phrasing and some intonation until I felt comfortable to be able to do with patients. And I think, again, what I started with is that people who own guns are not good people. They are not bad people. They are people who have made a choice for many different reasons, probably in terms of why they have a firearm in their home. They don't want their kids dying. They don't want their spouses dying. They may have different worldviews than you, or maybe similar worldviews about how they protect their family, but you have an opportunity to help them understand the risk of particular things, including suicide and unintentional violence. And that's, I think, where the focus really should be.
I'll just piggyback on what Emmy said, that it is so important to recognize the fact that the people who are most at risk of fire injury, the people we're talking about helping, the people we're worried about, it's gun owners. And so if you deep inside yourself have a problem with gun owners, there's going to be a tension there between your bias against the very group that you're purporting to want to reduce the risk of injury and death with. So I think it's really important to spend time, if that's not your culture, if that's not your, you know, experience, if it's not something you're familiar with, spend some time at ranges, at gun shops, go shooting, go learn about it, ask some of the instructors to show you their favorite firearms, have them talk about what it means to them and their family. Listen to people who, you know, bring their firearm with them everywhere they go in case they need it, in case they need to protect them. And get in that headspace of, if it's not where you, you know, normally live in your head, get in that headspace of why firearms are really important to people, why they mean so much to people, and why they're not just, you know, another object that's in the house. And I think that'll really help have respectful conversations and work on strategies to reduce risk that are like taking a harm reduction approach rather than sort of an absolutist, like, no more guns approach, because I don't think that's a realistic one.
Fully agree with both comments of Amy and Emmy. When we started our work in the 90s, we formed an advisory committee to help us stay on course, and we invited lifetime members of the NRA. We invited the executive of the Wisconsin Rifle and Pistol Association to be part of the discussion of how we can do better in understanding this problem. So couldn't agree with you more. And I think that's really important. The part I'm now engaging in more and more with our crime lab is that's where the firearms are for forensic purposes, is we're examining what the bullet does in gelatin. And I think understanding the dynamics of this is the same as understanding the dynamics of a car crash. And how does that inform our treatment of patients? And how does that inform policies that may help us reduce gun violence? So having trainees learning about what bullets do to human tissue, I think, is as important as getting diverse input on what we can do from firearm owners and from non-firearm owners. Everybody needs to be involved. So it's really a great ending question.
I honestly do not have a lot to add. I prepared this whole thing comparing it to doing a heads exam. So we already kind of touched on that, but just having empathy for your family, the patient, you don't know what they've been through. You don't know why they have a firearm. So my job is to be supportive of them and, you know, to provide another level of expertise, but they are that child's parent. They should be their child's advocate, and they know their child better than anyone else. So all I can do is support them and help them make good decisions. And I should not be able to say if it's good or bad, but good for their family and for that child, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for all of your words of wisdom and just like helping, you know, educate this medical students and future, you know, emergency medical physicians and whatever specialty we all choose on how, you know, to approach these topics, especially as, you know, medical education is changing and we're starting to learn at earlier stages how to really bring these things to light and bring it into our practice. So we really appreciate your time. Thank you to everyone for listening. We hope that has had a positive impact and that you can take away what you've learned to become catalysts in your own community.